Base is loaded, one out. Infielders are sort of halfway at second and short. Pena in a jam. The Twins are going to win the World Series. The Twins have won it. It's a base hit. It's a 1-0, 10-inning victory.
Welcome to Cobras and Fire. I'm your host, Luce Cannon, along with the disposable Baco. How are you, sir?
I am well, Luce. Good to hear from you. How are you?
I'm great. So, what do you want to talk about today?
1991! I was thinking like a year in review, something nobody's ever done.
Absolutely. I think that's a great idea.
Another high fresh concept. Fresh off the fire, Cobra and Fire idea.
Oh, yeah. Nice and original, as always. Mm-hmm. Innovators, Podcast Gold, episode number 40. So let's do this. 40. What's kind of the history of 1991? What we've been told, the whole, what happened in this year, Baco?
Well, the narrative typically goes that 1991 started out as pretty much just roses and plum cakes popping out of the asses of bands like, you know, Rat, Motley Crue, and Slaughter was just enjoying the riding high and
absolutely
on their second, you know,
up all night,
sleep
all day.
And they're getting ready to do some, I don't know, what was it, Wildlife, their second record, whatever.
Man, it's killing it.
Yeah, so all things were good, and then all of a sudden these three little assholes from Seattle come out, release a record, and then boom, Bobby Blotzer's buying vending machines. Everything would have been the same. Rat would have just continued to be exactly as successful as they had been for the previous decade if Nirvana had never released that one record. That's the narrative.
They are so pesky. I can't believe that those guys just ruined it. Ruined it for the whole Sunset Strip.
Dirty, stinky, coffee-drinking bastards.
I bet they really wanted to kill that guy at that time.
Don't you think it would maybe a couple years later? We'll get into that.
Yeah. Sure.
I don't think they knew at the time.
No, nothing like a little suicide humor. So we'll move past that. And we've hit rock bottom in 2 minutes. So all right, new let's record. Move past there.
New personal best.
New personal best. Oh man! All right. So yeah. So that's kind of the theme that we've always been told. I've heard that on a billion podcasts. People tell me that is the year that just like a big bottle of Raid killed hair metal dead. Right?
Yeah, that's exactly how it's
sold.
How it's often sold is a good way to put it. I mean,
okay. So what, before we get into that and get into the whole thing, and why don't we just start, you know, now that we just moved from something a little more, off color, I should say, why don't you go to kind of that list that you put together? Because you know, how much research did we do for this show?
Oh, tons. You know, I love these episodes, but man, it's so much work.
Tell me how much work it is, Baco. How much work, how much time did you spend doing this whole...
Well, I spent at least, looks like about 17 pages of printer, but most of that's ads.
Okay.
And my work paid for it. Hopefully they aren't listening. And exactly. I did it at work, too, so I was like,
good.
Paid to do it, so...
So who cares?
Well, but yeah, no, I mean, whatever. I mean, we approach things different. Obviously, we're having a little fun with our gold, what do you call that? Your sugar daddy.
The mothership,
Decibel Geek, because they, I don't know, have they done it? Any type of year in review episode? I'm not really sure.
I don't think so. So this might be an idea they might want to take.
Yeah,
from
but
us.
Well, they might want to use this then.
Good. Break it down.
But here's another idea I had. Since we're looking at 1991, why not talk about what things cost back then?
Sure. Why not? Well, everybody loves that.
A Russian mail order bride would have ran you about $5,000 in 1991.
Reasonable.
Yeah, not too bad. I mean, compared to today's prices of about $5,020.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A healthy baby on the black market would run you, on average, about $40,000.
Decent.
Yeah. An ounce of marijuana at a remarkably well-priced $150.
Solid. Excellent. I'll look into that.
A DWI. This was just at the beginning of MAD and SAD and DAD and all that stuff.
You know, so many acronyms.
A paltry $400 compared to now, that is a bargain if you're going to drive drunk.
Continue. If only I could get the DeLorean and go back in time with Vince Neil. But Vince Neil is my co-pilot.
In 86, killing somebody while driving drunk. It was 84 or 85. Whatever, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, there's a little bit of inflation there. But, man, I mean, come on. That's time. Vince could just continue. $400.
I had to do some
What is that voice? That's a terrible impression.
That's Vince Neil.
This is Vince Neil. Rock vocal power.
All right. Well, a compact disc, which we would call a CD back then, would run you about $14, and you could actually sell it back to the store for about $4. I think I just sold 400 CDs for $10.
I think that's what I got on eBay, and I was happy to get that.
Tickets to a Steelheart concert surprisingly were pretty much cost what they could do now. Whatever the headliner was charging.
Yes, okay.
A fake ID was only $30 and a pound of bacon was $1.88.
Solid. Good. Thank you for that little, Oh, that was a great history lesson, Bacco. Excellent, excellent.
Kind of wish I was there now.
Say again?
I just wish I could go back and buy myself a Russian mail order bride, a black market baby, and drive drunk with them in the car.
Perfect. Yes, we all have our dreams. So why don't we, before we get into the agenda that we kind of set, where were you kind of in this? I know you're a few years older than me, but 1991 is, where's Bacco at this time besides getting out of jail?
Well, largely well-behaved, but I was a freshman in college at the beginning of 1991, so it would have been my second semester. I was about to get dumped by the love of my life, who she is such a whore.
Okay, fair enough.
And I don't know. Me and my high school buddy, who you're about to be neighbors with, relatively speaking, we would do laundry and go hang out at a record store across the parking lot.
Did you actually just mention to me that you did laundry with your roommate?
But the reason was that it was in the same. We would go to this one laundromat specifically that wasn't really the closest one to our house because it had a music store in the same. They shared it was like a strip mall, but they were in different parts of the strip. And we would walk there, and we would basically we became like those assholes that the guys in the store get sick of.
Yes,
because we would buy plenty of music, but not when you put the amount of purchase per time spent in the store, it had to be pretty distant. But it was a lot of fun. A lot of drinking and hanging out with friends and doing college stuff. Digging a whole lot of stuff. It was a great year for music, if you ask me. And it actually is. And now that we were talking about this leading up to it, just kind of looking back. There's so many key parts of my life that I can tie to music from this just one year. So fuck it. It was great.
Yeah, that's.
Oh, and I drank a lot of Old Milwaukee. And in preparation for this show, I am wearing a hypercolor T-shirt, and my Doc Martens are tight as shit.
Nice. Yeah, I think that. Both of us pretty much had the same fashion choice in hats per the graphic for this.
I've never been a hat guy, so it's kind of odd that you found one.
Both of us are wearing it the improper way, like to the side or backwards, or it's quite ridiculous. But
mine was corduroy.
Was it corduroy? Yes, yeah. I think mine was some kind of plastic shiny material. I don't know.
It looked good,
it was solid.
What about you, Luce? What was a young, backwards, red hat wearing loose cannon doing running around the Hoosier State in 1991? What were you doing, man? What were you up to?
Well, sure. So my hometown is West Lafayette, Indiana, which is also where Purdue University, the fine institution, is located. And it was my senior year of high school. And, you know, I decided, besides it being me remembering, and part of it that I tie into this year a lot is there was a lot of basically stuff that I certainly remember that happened. First off, it's the transitional between high school and college, going to Purdue. So that's there. But and you know that you got that going on. But the main thing
you're
is
you're a Boilermaker. I'm learning something.
That's correct. That's correct. And you know what really you know makes me remember this year a lot, and it was great that there's so much good music, is because you bust my balls a lot of the time that I purge a lot of stuff, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're like polar opposites there, right?
Yeah, you're a hoarder. I'm a purger.
Yes.
Do you know why? I'll tell you why. This will help you of why it's easier for me to purge.
A little bit into the psyche of
loose
cannon.
Yes, yes.
Let me hear it.
Basically, there was a, and I don't know if it affected, it had to, well, I don't know. I know the winters are horrible there all the time, but the.
Oh, they're
but,
great.
Yeah, sure. So in 1991, though, in Indiana and Illinois, there was an ice storm that basically shut down Indiana, at least, for about 10 days. No electricity. It was all the stuff. And so everybody basically had their fireplace going all the time. And essentially, I'll just break this down really quick. House, everything I own, nothing that I own is more than 25 years old because our entire house burned down. In 91. Wow. So everything, we weren't, and no, I wasn't breathing fire like those Gene Simmons pictures. And it was something where basically, you know, the fireplace was being run all the time because nobody had electricity for like days. So it caught on fire. And we actually went out finally because the roads were paved. And when we came back, there's three fire departments. We went out for like showers and, you know, to bathe and stuff. We came back, boosh!
Fire!
All this music and everything that I've collected and all that stuff you hoard, it's gone. So I don't have as much connection to it as you. So does that help you?
That's an amazing insight. I had no idea.
Yeah. So my point being is that I realized the only – but really when it breaks down, there's only a few things that I miss, and that was kind of like you built your collection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're a kid and you build it up until 17.
Bigger.
You know, you get all these, you start, whenever you start collecting all that stuff, you know, you finally get the job that gets you the good stereo, all those kind of things. That's why I just don't have as much attachment to stuff. Yeah. But the music is the biggest thing that I miss. Cause I built like the whole Van Halen discography, Kiss, right. All that stuff. You build all that stuff and it's gone. Like, shit, I got to start from day one, but it's just not the same when you get it again. So, wasn't that fun?
Well, it's weird because like my penchant for not letting stuff go has a much less tragic reason, but a similar result. But it's nothing to do with 1991. So
no, I hear you. So that's why 1991 is stuff. I definitely remember that year because everything's gone. So what did survive was my 1981 Buick Skylark that I was driving around in. So that was pretty nice.
Well, I can confirm that our conversations have inspired me to kind of like let go of quite a bit of stuff in the last year or so.
But you know what I'm not going to let go of? I'm not going to let go of the rock of 1991. And I will put I will just say this right now, and I think it's an easy statement to make. Is that 1991 is probably, no, not probably, 1991 is the biggest year for rock, hard rock, and rock in general, ever. I'll tell you, my definition is in both critical and commercial success for hard rock bands or rock right. bands in general.
So with that specific definition, anybody who wants to counter that point, do so under that guise.
Yeah. I mean, you can't really argue with that. I mean, let's just look at – and 1991 is known as what? The year that grunge killed hair metal dead. That's what you always hear, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. So it's our argument, and it's our kind of purpose, our mission statement for this podcast, this episode, to just kind of break down about that what we've been told is not really what happened that year.
It maybe happened the year that Rock lived.
Yeah, the year that Rock lived in 92.
The year that Rock lived.
92, slowly the shift happened, 93. But before we go into kind of their releases and everything like that and just kind of revisit some great music and everything, what really happened to hair metal? Tell me what happened to hair metal or happened to hard rock in general.
Sure. Let me just break it down like this. This is what happened to hair metal. Extreme, Nelson, Mr. Big, White Lion, Poison, Enough's Enough, Whitesnake, Firehouse, Steelheart. It pains me a little bit because I mentioned bands that I actually enjoy there.
Yeah, yeah. Me too. I like Extreme. I like Poison.
But the reality is that, it really is more of like, instead of like a bullet to the head, let's just use the term grunge and just accept that's how we're going to describe it from here forth. Grunge was more of a rising out of the ashes. Or some kind of like secondary, it was almost like a necessity, like almost like a purging burn that was started. Like they were the ashes after the fire. Because like, you know, you got to remember like Guns N' Roses broke. And then all of a sudden you had, you know, and by the way, this stuff happened ahead of it. Like Motley Crue came big and they're largely responsible for Warrant and Poison. You know, things get lighter and lighter, more polished and more commercial. That's the way things work. It happened with grunge too. But Dangerous Toys, LA Guns, two bands that I love, but they really were basically signed to be Guns N' Roses. Let's see if we can't cash in on this thing. But that whole thing had been kind of dying. I mean, bands like Dokken had really, you know, kind of outlived their welcome. Rat released the same record 6 or 7 times.
Can I jump in here real quick?
Yeah.
Basically, there's good music and there's shit music, correct? Yes.
Okay. Yeah, well, there's an in-between.
But yeah. What I'm saying is that at some point, you know, and that's what we'll go into is there was tons of great releases from bands that I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, for with every genre or whatever, over time, just like whatever you want to call it, grunge, hair metal killed hair metal. You had like the third cousins.
Yeah, grunge killed grunge. I mean, let's
And same with hair metal. I mean, what you have is the ultimate, like the peak is like your Trickster, if you want to put it there. Like it goes from
had Trickster on the list too.
Yeah, so that's like the peak of
basically if you open for Kiss after 87, you're probably part of the problem.
I can see that as well. But, yeah, I mean, it basically, even if there hadn't been another big thing that came out or whatever you want to call it, and I'll even go to the fact that I don't even agree with the term grunge, and let me tell you why. I agree with a Seattle scene or something like that, but if you put someone into a room and you didn't have journalists and you didn't have record executives, you didn't have media telling you what something was, and somebody put on a Soundgarden album, all I ever
grunge.
Thought of... I know, but what I'm saying is, if you put on a Soundgarden album, all I would hear about, the first thing I thought about was, God, these guys got some great fucking Tony Iommi riffs, right? Sabbath, yeah, and it'd be like, this guy's fucking kick ass, and then if somebody came in and. Do that again, if somebody came in and said, here's Nirvana, what would you say? You'd be like, all right, this sounds different, you know. This
don't you think the big standout to your point though would be Pearl Jam or maybe Alice in Chains?
Yeah, well, both of those though. I mean, each. Okay, let's say that.
I think there's a little more overlap in Soundgarden and Nirvana as far as a tone.
I don't. I think there's
Nirvana is more punky, but like just something about the. I don't know.
No, I think that Soundgarden is.
I'm losing myself on this topic. So.
That's fine. I mean, I think Soundgarden has more, is tighter to Alice in Chains than any of the other ones, because they're both kind of those.
I do now too, so fuck it.
Okay, well, fine. And then Pearl Jam doesn't even have any of the DNA to me. I mean, this, you know, Eddie Vedder has a unique voice, but I think they're inherently more of a classic rock inspired band. So my point being is that they just painted the fact that they're in the same area, just like the LA bands. They just said, here's this, and these guys.
And by the way, the LA bands did, for the most part, have a more, there was more cohesiveness to their sound as far as like saying this band is all, this is the LA sound. Then I think you got out of Seattle early. The second phase was basically, I mean, because you even had like, you know, the second phase wasn't even Seattle. It was now bands like Seattle bands. It was like the Lemonheads and the Pumpkins. And I'm not ranking these bands or saying good or bad, but just, you know, it was kind of that thing. So
let's go to proving proof positive that 1991 was a great year for rock. So let's just pull any release out of your ass right now that came out in 1991 that wasn't grunge. Was there any number one albums from hard rock bands that year?
Well, I think Skid Row was number one that year, right? They were the first heavy metal. It was after SoundScan, by the way. It was the first time a hard rock band had ever gone number one, which proved that all the Billboard charts for record sales were all tied into politics and whatever. Once you had actual computer data, the first hard rock band to release a record that year goes to number one.
Yep, and I remember that being huge, and seeing like you know, Sebastian Bach was on the cover of Rolling Stone. They had, that was a huge, like, it was just, I remember that being a kind of a testament to like proving, you know, to me that this stuff, that people were listening to this music, right?
Get the fuck out.
Get the fuck out. Get the fuck out. Get the fuck out.
Now, let me ask you this. You bought the record when it came out, yes or no?
What? Yeah, day of release, 100%.
All right, man. Did you get the fuck out version or Beggar's Day or something on the other one? I think
it's,
I just took the hand
that
on which one I got.
Yeah, I have Get the Fuck Out, and my buddy, friend of the show, Rob, he has the one.
He
with
went
Beggars,
to Walmart.
Beggar's Day. Yeah, pretty much. He got the Beggar's Day one, and he loves the Beggar's Day. I didn't hear Beggar's Day until probably a decade later. I just didn't.
I heard it pretty early on because my roommate was one of those nerds that like had to have both, so he would actually buy the entire record again just to get one song. But I wouldn't do that until I had more disposable income later in life. But
sure.
I don't like the song. I like Get the Fuck Out much better.
Yeah, I actually go Beggar's Day now.
Get the fuck out.
Get the fuck out. Get the fuck out. Get the fuck out.
The point being is you can't really mess with that record. I mean, what are your thoughts on Slave of the Gods?
Five-star album.
Yep. And for all you people that are not here from the mothership Decibel Geek, definitely check out the albums Unleashed with Michael Wagner.
Oh yeah, it's fucking such a fun listen.
Yeah, it's a great listen. So definitely check that out. But you know, it's just hearing the background on that. But Slave to the Grind. I mean, I'm gonna throw this out, and the one album track that I will never skip is the
Can
Threat.
I get? Oh my God! I wrote the threat down. I'm gonna take a picture of it and text you. Hold on, I'm gonna turn up the sound on it so you can hear it.
Well, just the thing about the threat, and we're gonna play it right now for you people, is that drum roll. The drum roll in the beginning. Oh, I see it. There it is.
All right, man. Whatever. Yeah, I didn't know that we were actually gonna introduce the songs as we went, but yeah, the threat, bitch.
Shot!
Well, Luce, did the threat make you sweat?
It did. I am soaked in rock juice. And I, so
you only get so much rock juice.
That's true. Then you got to go to sleep afterwards. So, yeah, let's just move forward. I feel uncomfortable, as usual, with you with this kind of conversation. So we're going to go and, you know, it's your turn. I mean, this is the year that rock died. So, you know, why don't you let me know another band that just was just obliterated in the year 1991.
Well, I thought about touching on Motorhead, but I think if you want to talk about proof that grunge didn't kill anything, because I eventually want to actually talk about some of these so-called grunge bands, but Ozzy released No More Tears, and it is a fucking pretty good record, man. I'm not sure I would say it's best or maybe top three, but it's the second one with Zakk Wylde, and it's I don't know, it's got a lot of really good stuff on it.
I mean, but commercially, it was massive.
Oh, yeah.
Is this his biggest selling one?
Oh,
I think it is, right?
It actually might be. No. Remember, his first two were pretty big, and even Bark at the Moon was like 3 or 4 million. I don't know.
I still think this one might be the biggest, though, just because a couple of those singles are just massive.
But, you know, I do think it's as iconic as far as, like, that...
Oh my god!
I mean,
that's up there with
Crazy Train, and you know, as far as songs, you know, that people like when you hear it, you know, it's Ozzy. So,
100%. Yeah, I mean, that.
By the way, that big a fan of that tune.
Wow. Yeah, that's one of my favorites by him. But overall, I mean, that album it definitely hasn't aged as well as that. I remember loving it. And that year, but again, that's another one that just
there's no way I had it in 91. I got it in 92, and then I couldn't believe how much I liked it. I had checked out of Ozzy, but
right. No, and I was always more of a Black Sabbath fan than Ozzy solo, and he brought me back in with that album. I mean, hold on, I got my dog. Hold on.
Okay, you have a dog?
Out.
Ozzy Osbourne never recovered with his release, No More Tears.
Nobody
bought it.
I can't believe the album wasn't bigger.
Yeah, no, it's obviously it was a big record for him, and another sign that grunge didn't really destroy. It was more like if you sucked, you didn't have a future. But if you released something good, it was gonna be okay for you.
It actually did okay, yeah. It's just like another hand in the bush.
Yeah, another hand. It was just like that was brilliant. I love you right now.
Thank you. But yeah, I mean, again, another artist that was just brought down by the man named grunge. And you know, I mean, that's, you know, I'm trying to think of a track we can feature, but that, you know, there's just so many. There's great songs on it. It definitely helped Lemmy's bills for the next 25 years, right? I mean, he had at least two. I remember going through that.
Yeah,
because
he co-wrote Mama, I'm Coming Home
and Hellraiser.
Hellraiser, yeah.
There might have been a third, too. And I'm sure if there's any fact bastards out there that can help me with that, I don't have the liner notes in front of me. But I remember looking at that and seeing Kilmeister and being like, what? I cannot believe he wrote this song. You know what I mean?
Talk about two guys on the opposite ends of the making money in music spectrum.
Yep.
And they always maintained a pretty solid relationship. Like, it didn't seem like Lemmy ever felt ripped off by Ozzy, which seems to be a hard thing to do if you've worked with Ozzy.
Right.
And Ozzy maintained a pretty good friendship with him that actually seemed pretty genuine. So.
Yeah, the any other
while
news
ripping
about
him
Ozzy?
Off.
What now?
While ripping him off. No.
Any other news about Ozzy?
Well, did you hear he's getting a divorce?
I believe so.
And he's got a new reality TV show coming out. What are the odds that those two news items come out at the same time?
I'll tell you this, though. When I saw the whole news report about the fact that Ozzy's lost, we can't find him.
Yeah,
I love that. Yeah, I was like, Ozzy's not lost. He's hiding. I mean, that lady, anyway. So that's exactly what I would do.
That lady.
You would never see me again. I'd be just gone, vanished. But moving on, what's another possible artist that suffered a quick death in 1991?
Oh, well, I know Metallica kind of took a big step back with the release of the Black album.
Oh, I cannot. I mean, that was a commercial failure. It was just music poison for them.
I always felt guilty for liking it, like, because it was like one of those things. It's like I wasn't cool because I liked it. Like it's like I was the only one. I was like, seriously, guys, it's not that bad.
Yeah, the Black album, first off, I was looking at, it was hard to find. I don't know why it's so difficult to find the actual, like, you can always find the total sales to date for an album, but I can't seem to find how much online.
This one barely sold 20 million.
But I was trying to find out how much it sold that year.
It crawled to a paltry 20 million copies.
Yeah, it would have been 100 million. But
yeah, exactly, if it weren't for Nirvana.
Yeah, it wasn't for those damn Nirvana.
Damn it.
But, it was number one for, I think, 5 or 6 weeks is what I, the only, the,
at
from their,
best.
Their research. At best that year. And, you know, there's, I'll give some props to one other podcast called Rock and or Roll, which our friend Joey from Rock Strikes 10 guested on. They revisited the Black album, and they made some really good points. I mean, Joey was good. If you look at that, I think that do you still like it in retrospect?
Yeah.
Or no?
Yeah, I do.
You do, okay. I think that a lot of those songs just lack a lot of melody. Like, there's a lot of the things that are...
Metallica.
No. I'll just tell you this much. The Black album, I will go on record that I might even like Load more. What do you think of that? The first Load, not Reload, which is the after spray on the sheets of Load. I mean, it is just horrid, that one. And I know Load was a huge departure, but for Black, for me, the only thing that holds up for me for Black actually is I don't think any of the deep tracks, a.k.a. the 5 or 6 singles that they put out, are any good. Mm-hmm. What are some deep tracks for you on that album?
Oh, My Friend of Misery is a great song.
We'll be right back.
Okay, that one I'll give you. That one's good. What besides that, though? Do you like Don't Tread on Me?
I don't have it fucking sitting. No, I never liked Don't Tread on Me.
Good. What about...
That's the song that Kid Rock used, right?
No, that's Sad But True.
That's Sad But True. I never liked that one either.
Really? Okay. So that was one of the singles. What about... See, you can't even recall them.
Well, I don't it's one of the biggest. It. It's one of the biggest albums of all time. 25 years ago, we're gonna fight now. Ah, this is classic Cobras and Fire. Yeah, if you like Load Better, yeah, that's kind of fucked. I enjoyed Soundgarden quite a bit. They had a record that came out in 1991.
Little Bad Motorfinger, right?
Oh, what do you like them? You like that record?
I do. And the first song I ever heard was Outshined. And
yeah, same here, actually.
I mean, just to say, until people told us you had to, that's the thing I wanted to talk about too for this episode, is the whole bullshit of picking sides. You never should have to qualify, hey, I like Pearl Jam, even though they're a little different, or even though they don't wear spandex, or even though they don't do this, this song's really cool, or whatever, when you're talking to somebody that liked it. I liked all this stuff equally. I had a double cassette jam box that had Skid Row's, debut album, right, and the other one would be, you know, Alice in Chains' Facelift. I'd have Soundgarden with Metallica or Van Halen or whatever. I never thought of it, and this is before, because, like, Soundgarden and Alice in Chains, both of those were out before the, quote, Nirvana Pearl Jam at the end of the year, I think. I don't have that right in front of me, but I could, in my mind, I can
Nirvana
remember.
Nirvana was late. It was like,
it was like the
it
end
either.
Of the year. Yeah. I think I looked it up and it was like September or October. It was
yeah,
near the end.
Something like
of
that,
the,
yeah.
But like, did you think when you heard these bands though, that they were, did you not think that they were just hard rock? Or what, just, honestly, what did you?
Yeah, like, I mean, Nirvana I heard before all of it.
Really? You didn't even hear, so you didn't even hear Soundgarden or Alice in Chains before Nirvana?
If I did, it didn't stick.
Didn't hit.
Yeah, let's put it that way. And I never really got Nirvana. I did buy the Nevermind album, obviously, but it just never really, I was like, eh, I get it, I guess, but... But Soundgarden, when I got into Soundgarden, Outshine had been out for a while. When I got into Alice in Chains, it was after I saw them, like that came out in 90, and I saw them on the Clash of the Titans tour with Slayer, Anthrax, and Megadeth. And they were the opening act, and they were great. And then about 2 weeks after that, I heard the song Mad in the Box, which I had heard many times prior to that, but just whatever reason, it just didn't soak in. But now that I had seen them and I had a reference point, now I was paying a little more attention, and I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. And I think, you know what, there is a certain truth to that grunge killed music, and that's in the sense of, like, I think there's more, it's more, the music is coming from a more genuine place when we're talking about the big three or four, if you want to call them that, of the early grunge movement. I do think Nirvana, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, and I don't know who Soundgarden would be the
big four.
The big four, if you want to call them that.
Yeah.
And they definitely do from a fundamental belief in what they're doing and why they're doing it. There's more validity to their music than there is from Rat, who I love, or bands like Warrant or Poison or Slaughter that are kind of more or less following a very specific formula. And these are people who got good at what they did and just really never really had this, I don't know, this inbred passion for it that you felt with this first wave. But again, this was caused by them. It was like almost a reaction, you know, it was like an opposite reaction to something that was existing. But Soundgarden was one of my favorites. Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, probably my two favorites. And then it would be Pearl.
Can you go back to that Clash of the Titans tour
real
quick, though?
Yeah.
Now, when you saw them, I think you mentioned this in another episode, though, but did they kind of blend okay?
Like, yeah, I mean, you know, this is Minnesota. We're not mean to anybody. So they came out, and for me... Like, I had no idea what to expect, so they were great. I didn't actually notice this, like, oh, well, they're done. Now it's like this thrash stuff. But no, they were fine. And Lane Staley was just amazing. Sounded so good. And just listening to how tight this band was, because visually they were about as dull as you can get.
Yeah.
But they were tight and they sounded great and I loved it.
Yeah, and I'll say that and I don't have my, again, we didn't do any research. In my recollection, I think I saw, and we'll go into we'll bounce back from this year too, is I think it was 91 or it might have been 92 that I saw Van Halen and Alice in Chains together.
Oh, right, yeah.
And I know it was before Dirt, because Dirt would have been when they did.
No, it definitely was, because it was on the
Fuck Tour.
Fuck Tour, yeah.
Okay, so, but I never thought, this is so bizarre.
Speaking of which, since we're talking about 1991, if it's okay with you, I'm just going to quick open a Crystal Pepsi.
Oh, yeah, Crystal Pepsi. You make a little reference to Extreme there?
No, that was Van Halen. It did it right now.
Was that Crystal Pepsi?
Yeah, right now, drink Crystal Pepsi.
Oh, I did not know it was Crystal Pepsi. Jeez, that was a huge failure.
And Zima was awesome, too.
Exactly. A lot of clear liquids that died. My point is that when I saw them, I didn't think, gosh, this is so bizarre that they're putting this band with Van Halen. Because those are polar opposites by any... Right? I mean...
Yeah, but imagine being that one guy in treatment who's there because he's just super addicted to Zima.
I don't even understand what you're talking about.
Oh, we're talking Van Halen. No, Eddie loved Alice in Chains, and I remember Jerry Cantrell told a story that, like, I don't know, he was just, like, holding Eddie's gear and said, "Oh, this is really nice." And then, like, after the tour was done, he got home, and there was all this, like, free 5150 Eddie Van Halen gear just sitting in his garage that Eddie had sent him. So
very cool. The only interview I remember about Eddie Van Halen and Alice in Chains was he said, "Yeah, Alice in Chains, I really like them. They have really, really simple riffs, and their music is so simple." That was almost like insulting what he was saying to him. But did you ever read that?
I think he didn't mean it insulting, because it sounds like he was a pretty big fan.
That's cool.
Let's talk Bad Motor Figure.
Yeah, go ahead. So yeah, so go back to Soundgarden.
Well, Bad Motor Finger, I mean, like, what did you? I mean, everybody knows, like, you know, Rusty Cage and Outshined and God, well, Jesus Christ, Pose gets talked about a lot, but
yeah, I never liked that one. I still haven't.
I mean, I think it's okay.
It's okay, but I wouldn't say that is the one. So why don't you?
I'd be okay if they skipped it live.
Right. Yeah. No, I like the and overall, I don't know, like. I'm not sure which one I like better. I don't know if I like that or Super Unknown. I'm going to probably say Bad Motor Finger, but what's your...
Man, like, they're both right pretty awesome, aren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm actually really like Louder Than Love a lot. But
yeah, that one, not overall do I like, but it does have some great, great tracks on it.
That
as well.
Beginning, by the way, of Loud Love, where like the guitar's going, wah, wah, wah. And then, like, it just kind of melds into, like, a wah, and then all of a sudden Chris Cornell's voice, wah! One of the greatest intros in rock history, but Bad Motor Finger. I don't know. If you're asking me to pick something, I don't know. I like Somewhere. What do you think? I wish to wish, I dream to dream. That song. I don't know.
Yeah, that's cool.
Searching with my good eye.
Yes! No, let's do that one.
This is my good eye. Do you hear a cow? A rooster says...
Says. if that doesn't make you strap on some Doc Martens, some cargo shorts, and a sleeveless flannel, nothing will. This wraps up part one of Cobras and Fire 1991 Year in Review. Part two will be coming soon. And in part two, we continue to make the argument that 1991 is the greatest year in rock. And we will never say that about another year. I can almost guarantee that that is a lie. Anyway, up in part two, we talk about, you know, everything from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, LA Guns, Great White, David LaRoth. I think we touch on a little bit of Primus. I don't know. All sorts of good stuff that solidify the fact that, you know what, it may be a little bit of revisionist history to blame Nirvana for everything that happened to, I don't know, Pretty Boy Floyd. Anyway, for Loose Cannon, my name is Baco. Thank you for tuning into Cobras and Fire, and we'll see you on part two of the 1991 Year in Review. Bye-bye.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.